Bit. It's there. Well, hello everyone and welcome to another Deepest Lore. We're reviewing Adam Curtis for the 41st time. I'm joined by Simon. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm not happy at being surrounded by all these psychopaths in the online right.
Oh, that's really good.
He never stops, does he?
Oh, where is he?
His impressions are really quite good.
Does he cry during that interview? Go into a benzo.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
That's me told.
I mean, he does seem to be more and more like a woke moralist.
Yeah.
Doesn't he? Speaking of tears, do you remember this guy? The news cycle moves so fast that these things become like distant memories. But do you remember this dude?
This motherfucker talks about him wearing a suit. I hate this fucking country. I've never in my life felt like I do right now. This man has been respectful to every leader in the world.
Oh. I bet he feels stupid now. Oh my God, I shed all those tears and got really upset over what ended up being a 48-hour slop cycle.
Was that him putting that sort of a moving piano music on that clip, or was that somebody doing it?
I don't know. I just saw it coming around. it's St. George's Day.
God for Harry, England and St. George.
Which now basically revolves around various people calling him a Turk. which is a bit annoying how that happens, but it's kind of
it's the Otto English kind of recursion that we have to do every single year, where he smug posts about St. George being a Palestinian. You know, he doesn't do it so much when it's telling the Irish that St. Patrick wasn't Irish.
I see. I've never really done the St. Day like the. I mean, the St. Paddy's Day became a real tourist thing at one point, didn't it? Where, you know, oh, my great uncle is Irish, so I get to wear the big hat. You know, remember that whole thing in the 2000s?
Oh, it was awful. Everybody put on Irish accents. I mean, it was after people did Jamaican accents for a while, thinking they were cool. And then it was Irish accents. And every bloke down the pub was another pint of Guinness for you, darling, and all that kind of shite.
Yeah, top of the morning to you. I did have to wear the daffodil on St. David's Day and the leek and so on. Growing up, of course. But honestly, I often forget. I'm not very good at observing these particular days. Yeah.
Is the leek actually eaten, as in Henry V? Is it actually nibbled on?
Well, I mean, to be honest, they give you a little. It's a little felt. It's like a felt leek, you know. You don't burn actual. I mean, you'd look ridiculous with a real full size leek pinned to your shirt, wouldn't you?
I'd try it. Yeah.
Anyway, Horace, are you feeling patriotic today?
Good morning. I was thinking actually, if they did, you know, it's been called for that St. George's Day should be a bank holiday. If they do that, that will be the day with the most Palestinian demonstrations, won't it? Because they'll say, you know, it's Palestine's Day.
Oh, God.
I mean, I don't really care. I'm not Douglas Murray, but, you know, it will be something. And Otto English will be marching at the head of it, but a bit unsure of himself because he is. But yeah, I've been loving the continuing Douglas Murray, Constantine Kissin, Dave Smith drama palaver. It's very helpful. Boomer Truth regime in flames. Love it.
It's been relentless, hasn't it? How many shows do you think Douglas Murray has done since?
All of them.
And they're all the same. He just says the same twaddle on all of them. He's losing his reputation. It's really, really good to see.
I saw he went on the old Trigger Pod, you know, and I felt quite pointed because they were talking specifically about Winston Churchill as the cause of decline.
Yeah.
Who are they talking about?
Tucker and Daryl Cooper. Like, I've really got to give them credit for setting this fire last September because it's still burning. It's just brilliant.
So there we are.
Yeah. He's doing it a bit too much. I mean, it always reminds me of those lines in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Again, I always reference this book, but where they're talking about the possibility of trying to embarrass the Soviet Union. This is the English Secret Service or British Secret Service. And, you know, Smiley muses upon this and says, well, one of the problems of making your enemy look stupid is you sort of lose the justification for bigging him up as your enemy, which is kind of what Douglas is doing with all this protesting too much.
Can you do that in his voice, though, please?
I don't want to go there again. It was too haunting last week.
Yeah, your Douglas Murray last week was worryingly good, and your Jordan Peterson is worryingly good as
well. I felt like I've lived with them too long now.
I mean, did you see Rogan actually did his own version of the Have You Been?
Like that. I mean, that seems like a tiny thing, but that is them losing credibility with the biggest podcaster in the world, right?
Well, one of the
he's
biggest
much things, bigger than the BBC and stuff.
Well, one of the biggest things that has happened to us is that, I mean, I remember, you know, mapping all of these guys and Scrump and so on. I mean, we mapped the whole network out years ago, and we said, like, look, they always work. They're a network. They always walk in lockstep. You have to watch them. And for those of us who've been around for a while, it's always been really obvious, right? But you try to explain that to someone, and they think you're crazy, or they think that you've gone off the deep end or something. Now it's just been exposed because anybody who's not part of that network is like, what the hell are you doing? And anyone who is part of that network is like, oh, you know, furrowed brow, listen to Douglas and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, literally, they're lining up one by one to go on Rogan and tell Rogan off, you know.
That's the thing. That's the interesting thing about it. It's mostly a battle between them and Joe Rogan. They're pissed off with him. They already knew that people like, you know, Daryl Cooper existed or whatever. But it's Rogan and Tucker that they're furious with because that's what's actually changed the weather, them having these guys on. I mean, I've got to give a lot of credit to them. I think Joe Rogan's really boring. His podcast is just long, dull, and he asks dull questions. But just like it's often his accidents, just having these guys on and letting them talk a bit.
I don't know about you guys, but I have not watched any of it. Other than the clip, other than the Have You Been clip, right?
Yeah.
I have just been experiencing it second and third hand on my timeline.
I listened to one with Sam Harris last night, which is excruciating. Oh, it's a sort of weird, perverse pleasure that I sort of put myself through. But I think the strange thing is that Joe Rogan's own sense of boomer truthiness is what Douglas was fighting against. But because Rogan is like, you know, hey, free speech, man, let it all hang out. You know, well, this is what Douglas is coming up against, you know.
Sam Harris, I used to think was interesting about 10 years ago. I went through a year or two of listening to Sam Harris pretty much every week. And looking back, I just can't believe it. But when Trump appeared on the scene, sort of 2016, I guess, he lost his mind. He was the epitome of Trump derangement syndrome. And thereafter, probably until now, every single guest was just obsessed with Trump or Putin. It was ludicrous. And then he had people like Victor Davis Hanson as well, who's taken more seriously, who's like a creditable sort of right-leaning historian. He's a joke as well. He's an absolute joke. And he like, you know, there's three historians that they name to defend the Boomer Truth regime now. It's Andrew Roberts, Neil Ferguson, and Victor Davis Hanson. I've read one of Neil Ferguson's books, and it was actually quite good, the one of the Rothschilds, written in the 90s. But I haven't read their books on the Second World War. But I mean, judging from what they say in interviews, it's not worth it. They just, they, I mean, they know that they're not even being honest a lot of the time. But anyway, I won't go into all the details. But yeah, Sam Harris has been a hub for this stuff for a long time. I remember first getting an idea something was wrong when he had Michael Weiss on. I don't know if you guys know Michael Weiss, but he's like, he's some sort of spook stroke Zionist stroke, I don't know, but he's been working with Douglas Murray for a long, long time. He set up that, I can't remember the name of it, but some Israeli news service, basically, but in London. And yeah, Sam Harris, I just realized that, you're a neocon. Okay, you're a neocon. All right, what the hell have I been listening to you for? That was about 10 years ago. And this has been waiting to happen. I love to see it. Like Barry Weiss in disarray. She doesn't know what to do. Douglas Murray in complete disarray. They don't know. How do you shut down Joe Rogan? How do you shut down Tucker? You can't.
Do you know what's interesting as a kind of show of how things have changed so much in a small, you know, in the discourse? Is that many years ago, I was presenting this panel at the Shakespeare Association of America. And, you know, panel of professors and so on. And I was the kind of chair of this thing. And I said, like, you know, some of them were postmodernists and presentists and blah, blah, blah. And I started and I quoted Sam Harris on the importance of the truth in the post-truth moment, right? This was like 2016, something like that. And afterwards, the person, the professor, I won't say who it was, came up to me and they said, I can't believe you did that to me. I was like, what? Mentioning Sam Harris, talking about... And what they meant was, how could I bring up such a politically incorrect, unacceptable thing as Sam Harris, as if I'd, like, quoted Hitler or something, you know? it's just amazing thinking back to that moment, and I wonder how that would go now. I wonder if bringing up Sam Harris in that context wouldn't be thought of in that way anymore, you know.
Wow.
You remember the Ben Affleck moment, right? I don't know, was he on Bill Maher's show or something? But Ben Affleck saying that Sam Harris was beyond the pale, like absolutely appalling. Like, it's gross, it's racist. It's because Sam Harris was against, you know, some aspects of Islam. Well, yeah. Actually, Sam Harris is against Islam, the religion as well.
But, yeah, he is kind of like a left counter jihadi, left Zionist counter jihadi. Much like Douglas Murray, funny enough.
Right.
Yeah, that happens. Right. But Douglas Murray's a rightist. How does that work then? And how is it that when Douglas has got his tail between his legs, he crops up on Sam Harris? It's weird how that happens, isn't it?
I'll tell you, there's people on the left, sort of equivalently as left as we are right, I guess, who are aware of this as well. You know, they talk about the radical center. I think Tariq Ali used to talk about the radical center. This is what we're confronting right now. It's like the center left and the center right unite against everyone who actually believes in anything. And so they are just, I mean, they're all wings of the same sort of Houston Manifesto, Henry Jackson Society.
You know what I'm waiting for, Horace, don't you, right? The podcast where Douglas Murray goes on with David Baddiel. That's going to happen. Right. I guarantee you that's going to happen somehow. That Baddiel, right, with furrowed brow, is going to meet with Murray and they're going to talk about how it's a problem on both the left and the right. The country's gone mad.
Isn't it, I think David? Andrew Gold is the ideal interviewer for Douglas Murray, I think.
What, the kind of Tory London councillor guy?
I don't know what he is, actually. Yeah, I don't know if he's got a past, but he just does boring podcasts where he just says exactly what you'd expect of some sort of centrist, Zionist type, you know, just twaddle.
I suspected Baddiel because he'd have more cut through that way, wouldn't he? You know.
Well, Baddiel's been big on this, and Baddiel was one of those people who suddenly found his kind of Israeli roots.
Found exactly his Twitter profile.
On and around 10/7. There was a few of them who suddenly kind of, it was him, Adam Sandler, I'm trying to think of some others, who had like nominally been politically correct and left-wing and so on. But suddenly we're like, oh no, now I'm a nationalist for Israel. And I'm still left wing, but like I really love Israel too. And David Baddiel kind of made that move, as did Adam Sandler. And trying to think, there was one other one as well who made, David Schwimmer. He was the other one, David Schwimmer.
Militant David Schwimmer.
Yeah, seriously. David Schwimmer went from, am I really a white guy, though? Am I, like, I'm not really white, let's face it, you know, to, yeah, I fucking love Israel. In the space of, like, 2 years. So, yeah.
David Baddiel was already on that sort of books about anti-Semitism gravy train as well, wasn't he? Jews don't count.
Yeah, absolutely. He was the first.
They do count. And obviously his Twitter profile tells an elaborate story as well. His Twitter description.
Anyway, apart from speaking of that group, it was Easter recently, and I have to say, I would say 3.5 weeks off for Easter is unacceptable. 3.5 weeks off school is unacceptable and is affront to human rights, my personal human rights.
Is that what they did? 3.5 week break?
I mean, I don't ever remember having 3.5 weeks off. She only went back today.
We had two weeks when I was a kid, and that was a bumper holiday.
Oh, it's just interminable. And I tell you, I mean, I don't know, like, I don't know if every 5-year-old is like this, but the business as usual routine is something that I think AAA derives, like, comfort, security from. Whereas the anarchy of the holidays, you know, my carefully constructed bedtime routine out the bloody window, you know, just the rhythm of everyday life.
Yeah.
Disrupted. Oh, just interminable. It's just
because essentially, if they're cooped up at home, they turn into Jack Torrance from The Shining, basically, don't they? It's cabin fever.
Just unbelievable. I mean, and we had to do this homework last night where she had to tell the story of what she'd done for Easter. Now, she has done so much stuff for Easter. We went on picnic. She went on tons of play dates. She did this holiday camp. As I mentioned, we went to the, you know, had to get in the ambulance and go to the bloody hospital, all these different things. And her start was literally, I had a fun Easter. I watched Minions and Despicable Me. Then Gru, who is the, you know, the character from Despicable Me, was in the car park. And me and my friends went in the tent. And I was like, all of this stuff is made up. Like, none of this stuff happened. So then when I was actually trying to get her to get the actual stuff that happened, we only had like half the space left. And it took out, I mean, she dragged it out. It took about 2 hours. And then she was like, oh, I'm going to do capital E's now. I was like, no, you do a little E. No, I'm going to do capital E's. No, I do little E, capital E, you know. And I was just, talk about Jack Torrance. Bloody hell, Simon. I was ready to get, you know.
Gosh.
Anyway, so that last night was difficult because of that.
Literally sounds a bit like Italy, the topic of today's live stream.
Yes, what a transition.
Great segue.
If you mention the transition and the segue, then it sort of subtracts from it. I was trying to be as smooth and connected as possible.
Yeah, very, very Radio 4. Well done.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, of course, you could transition before, but now that fascist Keir Starmer's got his way. Just before
we get going, yours woke moralists.
Yeah,
let's see who transitions who.
Horace, anything you want to plug, sir?
I think I'm going to do an essay on Substack about the furore, but I haven't done it yet. But my Substack is below the video.
Simon, anything you want to plug?
On Saturday evening, I'll be on with Proper Horror Show again. We're going to be talking about The Uncanny, Das Heimlich, the Freud essay and its impact on film. So join us for that. I should also say apologies for the confusion and delay that I've caused today. This was because I didn't quite convey that we were going to skip the order that these films come in at the moment. We were supposed to do The Great British Housing Disaster this week, but that's the strict chronological order. We are going to sort of just leap ahead, do this one, The Mayor of Monte Maloney, and then we'll be having a special guest next week, we hope.
And I'll just remind people, do pick up, Foundations of Shakespeare, Trivium, et cetera, et cetera. Trivium, many people taking that at the moment. Don't know why, maybe Easter prompted people like, oh, I better learn my grammar now, because a lot of people have bought that in the past couple of days. All right, so let's get going with this. Oh, I tell you, I'm still having flashbacks to the 2-hour session. You know, I need you to do a little E. No, I'm going to do a capital E. Oh, for fuck's sake. You know, I was losing my rag towards the end. I wish I just had a cane. I actually resorted, Simon, to saying, look, if you don't do that properly, I'm going to send... She watched the start of that film, Matilda. You know, the...
Oh, yeah.
That's actually a nightmarish film. Yeah. And at the start of the film, Miss Trunchbull, who's a horrible, like, hot, massive woman, grabs this girl by the pigtails and throws her over the thing. And I said, look, if you don't bloody do this properly without messing around, I'm going to send you to that school with Miss Trunchbull. And she was like, no, don't. I was like, write a bloody proper E then. Wow. Anyway, let's carry on. Amazing. This is amazing. Amazing. Well, we have to talk about the aesthetics of 80s Italy. Simon, yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah. 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 Old blokes tanned with medallions on, chewing on a fag, sunglasses by Lake Como. What a great life. This is from a series called Italians. This is a portrait of Italy today, seen through the lives of 10 different Italians. It was done in 1984. They covered all sorts of characters, fishermen, ballet dancers, you name it. And this was quite an entertaining episode in itself. So might as well hit the history here. That's the PCI, and that's the Partito Comunista Italiano, and that's the Italian Communist Party. This particular episode is very interesting in the way it's showing us the kind of twilight, the moment of death of the Italian Communist Party. So essentially, the Communist Party started with people like Antonio Gramsci and Togliatti back in the 20s, and it was suppressed under the rule of Mr. Mussolini. And essentially, by this point, it had undergone a number of changes. It had been very successful after the war, because the war, obviously, a lot of the resistance was organized. About 60% of the resistance was organized by the Communist Party. And the thing about the Italian Communist Party was, from the start, there was really a kind of split in the party between the people like Gramsci, who were kind of, you could say, more, you know, democratist in a way, and Togliatti, who was kind of Moscow's guy. So there was always a tension about emulating the Stalinist parties around Europe, which kind of, you know, took their orders from Moscow Center in policy terms. The Italians wanted to go in a different way that sort of was based in tradition, was looking into a kind of futurism like the Soviets were, but had this element of democracy in the party, which seems strange for communism. But they, as a result of their time in the war organizing resistance, they kind of came to the table with a lot of support at the end of the war, and they were able to put sort of social democratic principles into the Italian constitution, which were, you know, essentially, it boiled down to things like sort of workers' participation and essentially a kind of a social democracy for Italy.
Sorry to interrupt, Simon, but one of the few things I do know about the Italian communists, isn't it true, maybe Horace knows this, that when the big chin man, you know, they strung him up and kind of hung him from a lamppost or whatever it was, that, you know, it's always made to look like, well, that was the Italian people, but actually it was communist partisans. Is that true?
But, very likely, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was communist partisans, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they were a great proportion of the actual resistance at the time, and they managed to kind of marry a lot of interests. You know, you sort of would have your working men who would follow them, but also the young intellectuals, and even some liberals and monarchists actually worked with them as well. So that's why they came to the party, so to speak, at the end of the war with quite a big chunk of vote, around 2 million members in the early 50s. So it wasn't kind of a democratic organization in actu, but it was very unified. It wasn't as schismatic as perhaps other European communist parties were. But it gave a sort of access to the working class to have some sort of democratic voice after it had been so restrained under Big Chin Man. And this was important because Italy was going to industrialize very rapidly in the post-war era, and it meant that they had a power base of people invested in the party as the working class, and you didn't kind of need elite education or connections to rise in this particular party. So the thing that when they conceived of the Italian Communist Party was that they thought of it specifically as a mass party, which is distinct from a vanguard elite like the Soviet communists. They wanted people to, if you like, have mass representation and act and coordinate collectively insofar as was possible. There was obviously the intellectual elite, I suppose, at the top of the party, but it wasn't the kind of vanguardism, I suppose, that, you know, Lenin would have personified.
Now this surprises me that Gramsci was on that side, given his writings and given his, you know, kind of elitism inherent in his ideas of the intellectuals and so on. It kind of surprises me that they went for this democratic solution.
It was called the Italian Road to Socialism. So essentially it was that they thought by passing through with this democratic participation through socialism, I think Lenin said the inevitable destination of socialism was communism, wasn't it? So they felt this was going to be a subtler and a better way. And to draw perhaps, you know, some of that sense that people, you know, they localize ideologies to their own country, and they felt this was going to work better in Italy than the kind of Soviet model would work. So they would have a kind of a plan in place to bring in when you know, the moment happened. I mean, a lot of the partisans kept their arms and kept them hidden. And there was a sort of moment later on where it looked like, you know, they were going to almost seize power. But the party took a kind of non-violence approach, doing it by, you know, this Gramscian slow gradualism, this incrementalism, to try and identify particularly with the Italian people.
I just wanted to add something. I don't know if you've already watched this documentary, Simon, but do we come in, I'm guessing what we're going to see here is mostly to do with the 90s, right, or 80s, sorry.
Yeah.
So we're just filling in a little bit of the sort of between the Second World War and that here, right? I would just say to people, like, be aware that although this Communist Party was more democratic and perhaps more humane and more prepared to work with the system to some extent, it was still regarded by the Western states, like especially the CIA, as a terrible threat, because if they took power, they still might change their mind. I think this is the CIA's view. They might still just align with the Soviet Union anyway. Yeah. So there was this general election in 1948. And the CIA, I think it was the first known instance of the CIA. I think they actually had to ask Congress for new powers and stuff, but to interfere with this election and just to ensure that the communists didn't win, which effort was very successful. And I think the communists lost heavily in the end. But they were popular. They had millions and millions of supporters, including in rural areas, I think, as well as the cities, which is quite unusual in some countries. And yeah, obviously the CIA and the broader sort of anti-communist,
the Italian intelligence services as well.
Ah, right. Okay. So I guess you might mention like Giulio Andreotti, mm-hmm. who became prime minister and was prime minister several times and for a long time. I mean, people like him just talk about quite openly that they worked with the CIA and to just ensure that the communists never took power. Democracy comes second to anti-communism at this point. Yeah. And what was the other thing I was going to say about it? Well, just Eurocommunism arose among these people in the 70s, I think, which was, again, another difference between Italian communism and Soviet communism.
Yeah.
Not something I can explain that well. Maybe you guys know more about that, but you mentioned that Berlinguer figure. Yeah, Eurocommunism is generally cursed by Stalinists.
Yeah, Enrico Berlinguer, he is the guy. So when we hit the beginning of this documentary, I think he's just died. He's the leader of the Communist Party at this point. And he was trying, because for many years, about 35, maybe 40 years, the Christian Democrats had been the dominant party in Italy. And at a certain point, in the sort of 60s, they found the Communist Party was sort of weren't making headway. They were consolidating their electoral gains, but they weren't getting any closer to an idea of cooperation with government. I mean, they represented roughly 32 to 34% of the vote at their height. And the idea was...
The Communists did you say?
The Communists did, yeah.
Bloody hell.
They had massive traction, but it wasn't quite enough. And they didn't acquire sufficient traction, if you like, in elite circles to be able to make a difference despite the sort of size of mandate they were representing. And there was a kind of emergence of, by the 60s, some of the original guys were starting to fall away from the Communist Party, who'd been with it through the war. And there was a sort of a new surge of political radicalism, which wasn't being managed by the Communist Party, which was happening in workplaces like Fiat. And there was sort of a much more militant and aggressive kind of form of worker engagement with capitalism that wasn't their style. The Communist Party had been very clear about wanting to do this in a gradualist, non-violent way. And at that time, you were starting to see an extreme kind of mentality coming into the minds of workers in Italy. And so what happened was Berlinguer, who was around from, I think, 1969 onwards as the leader, decided to do something which was called the Historic Compromise, which was essentially to offer to ally with the Christian Democrats so they could try and influence government power a bit more, government policy a bit more. The problem, unfortunately, came, it sort of ended. It was a period, short period in the 70s, maybe it ended with the assassination of Aldo Moro. That kind of fell away because it was then felt that radicalism, left-wing radicalism, the Red Brigades and so on, were going to present clear and present danger to the Italian state. And so the elements on the right and the intelligence services started to, really focus and crack down more. And also the thing you had with Allende in being overthrown in Chile, Berlinguer basically decided that you couldn't be an ultra-radical Marxist left and aspire to govern in a democratic country without establishing alliances with more moderate people. And so he...
Because Allende was elected and he wasn't crazy. He wasn't a paramilitary.
No.
He was like a legit leader, right?
Yeah. And of course, we can say that, let's say, communist governments present certain kinds of threats to certain countries in the world and maybe they take covert action to deal with that. And Berlinguer formed this notion of Eurocommunism to kind of soften it. And Peter Hitchens often, refers to this, talking about the origins of, New Labour as a derivative of Eurocommunism. That in itself wasn't quite what we have come to know. At this time, in 1984, they've got a socialist PM, and the socialists had been kind of in awe of the Communist Party, or it's subordinate to them for decades. They'd never quite cut through, but they got a socialist PM, Bettino Craxi, elected at this point, and he essentially developed what was called Craxism. It was essentially this sort of mix of social democracy and sort of liberal conservatism socially. And so they would sort of have, environmental policies. They would sort of be very sympathetic to the third world, but they'd support and believe in the welfare state, but they'd be, pro-American, a greater European project. They would be into privatization. Essentially,
Like Ursula von der Leyen.
It sounds very much, and of course, at this time in Britain, one Anthony Charles Linton Blair has just been elected, and his eye is seeking out ways to reform the radical left and get them into power. And guess where he looks?
You mean elected to Parliament, don't you?
Yeah, elected as MP. So there's definitely an influence. I mean, Craxi was corrupt, and he kind of literally fled the country because of that, and died. I think it was in Tunisia. But certainly the idea of this blend of if you like, you know, big state with the neoliberalism that we come to, you know, live under, is something that is seen as quite influential in his brief time.
May I just ask about something you mentioned, the Red Brigades? Would I be right in thinking they were obviously a militant or terrorist group? Were they completely separate from the PCI?
Yes.
Do we know? Yeah.
They were a whole different
ideology.
It seems like these radicals were a distance from the Communist Party, which, as you say, was kind of had a very workmanlike approach. You know, it did have a lot of support in the northern industrial cities, and it did have some support out in the countryside. But as we'll see,
Torino famously a sort of communist stronghold.
Yeah, and you know they held on to that, I think, for the longest of any of the parties in Italy. And as we go on, we see, I mean, Italy's actually becoming pretty prosperous. And by the time of the mid 80s, it's reported that the GDP per capita is higher than Britain's. Yeah, and I suppose things like go on.
Oh well, no, sorry, were you finished? I was just going to ask, was Torino also the main site of the Fiat production?
Car production, yeah.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, Fiat is a massive company. It's not just the Fiat car brand. It's they own like Ferrari and other stuff. They own like, Fiat is like, I think, the biggest company or the biggest manufacturing company in Italy. And it's like, I don't know exactly how it works, but the Agnelli family controls it or has always controlled it, right? And that Gianni Agnelli was a famous figure in many ways. I think, you know, he's like a globalist elite figure as well, like Bilderberger and all sorts. I don't know, just in with everybody. And the Agnelli family is like certain other sort of quasi-aristocratic business families in Europe, like the people who own the Ferrero brand and the Ferrero company in Italy as well. But yeah, like Fiat, obviously, that's like in Torino and other places, that's like one site where tens of thousands of heavy industry workers are gathered in one place. That is a target for communists, you know. In there's probably the equivalent of something like Citroën or Peugeot in France, and you know, other companies like this. Like the one company is so enormous that it's of like national importance. It's in a sense too big to fail, but in terms of communism, so yeah, that Gianni Agnelli. I know that he wasn't he a member of Propaganda Due, the strangely named Freemasonic lodge. But I don't know, I'll probably go off into too big a tangent, but I'll just mean like the P2 lodge or Propaganda Due, like Propaganda 2, I think that means.
I think I came across that name in connection with that, yeah.
Yeah, loads of famous people seem to have been a member of this particular Masonic lodge. It's obviously more important than most, including, what's that prime minister there was for years who owned Milan Football Club? Berlusconi. Silvio Berlusconi. Yeah. So he's been a big, you know, I don't know if he's still alive, but he's been a big figure in Italian history for a long time.
Well, I think one of the things that Craxi did was he liberalized ownership of things like TV stations and so on, which is where Berlusconi got his entry.
So he bought several TV stations, I think at least one football club and all sorts, and he became like a multi-billionaire. But yeah, there's loads of stuff to do with communist terrorism, because I think there were false flag attacks blamed on the communists, maybe, and the Red Brigades and the fight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did certain murders, ostensibly, they did a train bombing in Bologna, I think. Was blamed on them. I don't know if it really was them. But this Propaganda Due lodge that seems to have, you know, people in politics, media, civil service, everything. They were like the other side of that fight in a way. They were like the state and hard right side of it. Well, not actually hard right, but, you know, anti-communist. And, yeah, just that's part of the context. That's not directly part of this story. But, yeah. But anyway, Fiat, Gianni Agnelli, I think, was, you know, as the head of Fiat, was part of that. And, yeah, so obviously had many interests in defeating communism, even the milder version.
Yeah, I mean, my knowledge of Italian politics is rather scant. But the things I've picked up here and there. One of the books on Julius Evola, I mean, not just contact with Evola's own writings, but there's this book called Evola, the Sufi of Rome, by this guy, Jelly, who I actually met in real life. He's a priest. I met him at an event once. He talks about being a young man going to kind of study at the feet of the sage. And from all accounts, post-war Italy had a lot of kind of youth ferment. The youth were radicalized one way or the other. you know, so you actually did get pretty right-wing young men, right? Mm-hmm. Who, I mean, if you read Evola's A Handbook for Right-Wing Youth, this is the audience of it. Evola was pretty widely read among them. But one of the stories that Jerry tells in that book is that one of these students who'd been, you know, going to these little sessions in Evola's office suddenly disappeared one day when it was revealed that he joined the communists, right? And that he'd actually been like a communist spy to see what Evola was talking about and so on and so forth. And he tells a story of Evola's reaction, and apparently Evola just laughed. But it just goes to show you that it was actually theoretically possible for a young communist to come into contact with someone like Evola, and even to for there to be like weird cross-pollination, because it's just radical politics in general, right or left. The other thing I when I was growing up, I liked that club you just mentioned, AC Milan. I was a fan of theirs in the 90s, and I even went to their stadium and saw a couple of games and things like that. And one of the things I always remember is that in Milan, AC Milan was the left wing club, it was like the club for the workers, and Inter was more kind of like middle class or aristocratic or whatever. Yeah. And was the kind of the right-wing club. And that politics isn't like some skin-deep thing. Even though Berlusconi bought the club, the ultras in Milan were still left-wing, and the ultras in Inter were still right-wing. When I say right-wing, like, they go pretty far, like all the way to Paolo Di Canio type, you know, they go all the way right-wing in Italy. But I remember that when Paolo Maldini retired, who was an absolute legend of the club, and you know, you'd think he's like one of the best players of all time.
He is one of the best ever, yeah.
Yeah, and he played for Milan. He was a one-man club. He played from the age of 16 to the age of 40. He'd won so many five European Cups, I think. Right, an absolute legend. Couldn't get a more legendary player. But on the day he retired, a section of the fans still booed him, still weren't happy with him, because, right, he was not seen as one of them. He was seen as aloof. He was seen as middle or upper class, not for the workers, too loyal to the likes of Berlusconi, you know, a kind of company man as opposed to the people's man type thing. So
and
it even
was rich and famous as well.
Yeah, it even plays into things on that level, which really surprised me. I was like, because you'd have thought any Milan fan would just worship Maldini, right? But that was not the case. Like, there was always a section of the fans who didn't like him because he was, you know, not a comrade, if that makes any sense. So
yeah,
anyway, yeah,
it's really interesting you're talking about football actually as a kind of vector of political unification to some extent, as we see sort of later with Blair, you know, the way that football took off as a thing. This was the kind of the problem in Italy, was that there was a kind of thing where Craxi came in because there wasn't really anything representing a kind of moderate center-left position. You know, there were those kinds of parties in it, but they weren't getting anywhere in Italy. And so this idea of marrying up, I mean, this thing of turning away from Moscow as the kind of directive force in, you know, international socialism, communism, and trying to find a sort of a Europeanist kind of solution. That's sort of it makes me wonder if there's some connection here with the way football gets used to kind of soften the ground a bit and create a bit. I mean, the way it was emphasized in the Blair years of you know, creating a sort of a sense of unity and fun, and it became middle class. Yeah, that kind of center left constituency gets in there.
Berlusconi buying Milan, I know, was seen as a move to make the club more "quote unquote" apolitical, or less of a kind of political thing. If that makes any sense, if that's possible with a figure like Berlusconi. But if you think like in their politics, Berlusconi is more like a Thatcher, I guess, or even a Farage type figure. Mm. He's centre right, not like, even though he leans into the populism, or he leant into populism. And he said outrageous things. He's kind of still in that ballpark. You know, he was kind of pro-market and, you know,
chauvinistic kind of entrepreneurialism. Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of a figure like that. One last thing to mention before we play this, Simon, is that one of the things I'm going to be keeping in mind is the extent to which Italy, a country like Italy, actually couldn't be properly free market, maybe ever. They'd had the big chin man there, right, which was basically like state-driven or state-backed, lots of state controls, right, under fascism, or state-backed capitalism, whichever way you look at it. But whether actually one of the reasons this communist party that we're talking about gained popularity and, you know, was a live force, you know, getting 20-30% of the vote, is because actually Italy needed something to prop up its, you know, its industries and its manufacturing base and so on and so forth. You could say the same thing about this country, which was basically, I mean, you look at the Attlee government and Wilson and so on, it's basically the same, isn't it?
There's a lot of sympathy with the kind of dirigiste kind of approach in Western European countries.
There seems to have not really been any debate about that. The furthest right position was still dirigiste to some extent, right? In Europe. It's like that's often why they refer to free market ideas as Anglo-Saxon, because it really is not common. It's not a common position on the continent, I don't think. There's obviously the Austrian school, but they're mostly in America. dirigisme in, you know, after 1945 became the norm across Europe, right? Well, across Western Europe, at least.
This book I've got, you know, Exporting the American Model by Jellick, I've mentioned it a few times, basically says, like, the American, like, when they put the Marshall aid in there and they sent American advisors in, they basically found that huge amount of European industry was still like wrapped up in the old guild structure and like old kind of like the, not just the guilds, but like old families that were connected to them, and, you know, Habsburgs and things like this were all still kind of very intermeshed with the economies of all of these places. And what they wanted to do under Marshall aid was to try to break all of that up and remake it in a kind of an American corporate model, to open it up to allow more competition to, and there's an argument to say that they never quite succeeded in that, because they may have smashed some of those old structures, but if you have a look, they basically ended up reforming under things like Nestle, or, you know, these massive European corporations, Unilever, which end up basically just being like working monopolies or duopolies in every single market. And they have, I remember this is something that Thomas Sowell talks about in Basic Economics, where if you have a look at the top 100 American companies from decade to decade to decade, they keep on changing all the time. If you look at the top 100 European countries, they're a lot more static, right? They just don't go anywhere. Like it's always Nestle, or it's always, you know, you pick a big European brand, but they never quite go away. So this is another interesting aspect of, I just like, you just the continent in general doesn't really like the free market for us. You know,
no, it's true, absolutely true. It's more just a British and American idea, and obviously among like the Austrian school, who sort of stand out. But yeah, they didn't really, the Austrian school never had much purchase on the continent at all, did they? So I would just say as well, just to tie everything back together, like the center right in Italy, and I think probably in France and other countries, and Germany as well, like it's not, they don't call themselves conservative parties exactly. They don't call themselves, you know, what we're used to, Republicans or anything like that. It's always Christian Democracy, right? That's the name of the right wing. I mean, not in France, that's not the name of the party, but Christian Democracy does not mean the same as like the Tory party. I don't really understand what it is, but it's quite openly, like overtly more okay with the state and with with social conservatism and with, you know, the centre left. They do see themselves as in partnership with the centre left, and this is especially so thanks to the Cold War context, in which the centre right and the centre left were both supported by the American state, right, across Europe. You know, the centre left in the form of what Frances Stoner Saunders talks about in her book, and the centre right in the form of like stuff like Operation Gladio, which yeah. And Operation Gladio, it's no accident that it had an Italian name. Well, maybe it is an accident, but when I think of Gladio, I think especially of Italy, also France, but especially Italy. It's where the threat, even though the Communist Party was perhaps more moderate, the threat of communism was biggest because they were the most popular. And yeah, the American state was supporting all centrist politics across Western Europe all through the Cold War. So on both sides.
Io sono emigrato nel 1959 a Torino per ragioni di lavoro. E ho fatto un po' tutti i lavori, dal manovale in una industria che costruiva cerchi di biciclette, all'impiegato, poi...
Sorry, just a very brief introduction. He mentioned bicycle wheels. If anybody wants to watch a movie, I think it's a leftist movie, but about Italy set in this time, it's called The Bicycle Thieves, or just, there's no the. Bicycle Thieves is the name. And it's a bloody excellent film. Really, really recommend it. Anyway, sorry, back to the thing.
Interesting point just to say there, his thing about leaving the town and going off to Turin to find work. I was just struck, actually, at thinking about that video that Carl Benjamin did the other day where he was wandering around Swindon and it looks kind of completely hollowed out. But one of the themes of the Monte Milone, the town, is mass emigration, people leaving, you know. And it ends up being 70% old people at this point, you know.
Lavorando e studiando, mi sono laureato e sono entrato nel mondo della scuola. Avevo una rivincita da fare, cioè quella, ed era un primo mio sogno che si è avverato, quello di ritornare e poter mettere a disposizione della mia collettività, del mio paese, quanto avevo appreso a Torino, che era una società che marciava ad un ritmo molto più accelerato rispetto al nostro, che era totalmente quasi fermo, come se il mondo si fosse fermato.
I have to say, Simon, it looks nicer than Swindon, mate.
I must say it does. Although it's because it's probably sunbaked there and Mediterranean looking. Although if you go on to, I went on to Google Street View and had a wander around Monte Milone, and my God, it's grim. It's in this region called Basilicata. You know, if you think of the foot of Italy, the toe is Calabria and the heel is Campania, and the bit in the middle is Basilicata. And these are the poorest regions of Italy. Basilicata is not actually one of the poorest. It's sort of the second richest out of these sort of eight regions. So you can imagine what the really poor places like Calabria are like. I mean, if you've ever seen the film Gomorrah, you'll get an idea of what we're talking about. But you go and have a look at this place now, and these people are dirt poor, at least if you look at the sort of the state of the housing and the infrastructure.
It's always a little bit extra tragic when the name of the place mocks it as well, because apparently Monte Milone means like fruitful hill or bountiful hill. Alas.
E questo paese è stato immobilizzato per oltre 30 anni, perché la nostra società, avendo avuto un'enorme emigrazione, i giovani sono andati via, gli anziani sono rimasti, per cui la popolazione ha la sua caratteristica del 70% di anziani, e questi anziani erano lì sulle panchine del paese aspettando come tante...
My God, they just sit there waiting for death like turtles in the sun.
Yeah, it's a great phrase, isn't it?
Wow. Can you imagine a mayor today talking like that?
The mayor of Swindon comes out. The people are waiting for death like turtles in the sun.
Testuggini al sole che la morte arrivasse.
The mayor of Monte Milone is a communist, the first the town has ever had. The election of Dino Labriola 5 years ago was part of the Italian Communist Party's strategy of seeking power in the remote, depressed regions of the South.
Pronto? Sì? Pronto? 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 Non ti preoccupare, ci do... Ti telefono poi domani. Ciao. Venerdì, va bene. D'accordo, ciao. Che casino mi sta succedendo?
Dino's running a town that's been bleeding to death for years through emigration. There are no jobs. His job is to halt the exodus that's halved the population in 10 years. Dino started training schemes to provide work for the unemployed young. A new water tower is badly needed in a part of Italy where there's never enough water for irrigation. The mayor is also the site boss.
Ciao, chiamo un pochettino i ragazzi.
Ragazzi!
Vi sbrigate? Oh, questi ragazzi devono imparare a lavorare, come si deve. Perché stiamo perdendo del tempo a fare questa struttura qua. Senza perdere tempo e senza tanti giochi. Perché sono soldi che noi usiamo, sono pubblici, che vuol dire che li mettiamo anche noi.
I like the fact he's given them an Antonio Conte style dressing down. That's pretty good.
I've got to pick up on his approach here. He's telling them, he's just told them it's public money. You know, you shouldn't waste time because it's public money. It's coming out of our pockets. Mm. This is a classic delusion of all socialists. They don't give a fuck. They're getting the money in their pockets. That's what matters. If they can do that without working, that's better. You know, just asking people to be better is a hopeless strategy.
D'accordo?
Sì.
Allora adesso andate a lavorare.
Proseguite. Continuate a...
But Dino has come face to face with the ancient lethargy of the South. And it's difficult to produce jobs out of nothing.
Do you think the BBC got any complaints about the line "the ancient lethargy of the South"?
I did
some Italian ice cream shop owners wrote in, being like, "Hey, you're talking about my people.
We're not lazy." The music for anyone who's interested is "Voglio Vederti Danzare." It was a hit in 1982 for Franco Battiato.
Did you just recognize that?
No, I had to look it up. I did a Shazam on it because I couldn't quite work it out. But
I object to the phrase "the lethargy of the South." They shouldn't just characterize people like that. There's reasons, you know. Seriously, there's always reasons, you know. It's not just like they just became lazy there. That's just bollocks.
I will say there is a massive difference, right, between, you know, I've talked about Thomas Carlyle in the past, and I've talked about Evola earlier on. If there's one difference between Evola and Carlyle, it is on this question of work, right? Because Carlyle is like, work is good. It's good in and of itself. You know, if you work, it brings you closer to God. If you won't work, if you don't work, you should be whipped until you do work for your own good. Whereas Evola's view is like, basically, like, if you know, there's nothing inherently good about work whatsoever. And his attitude to it is, I mean, I hate to say it, it's a mad attitude against the very Protestant work ethic attitude of Carlyle. And I mean, this must be a deep, deep rooted cultural thing, you know.
Was very Carlyle by attitude. Any chance? I could look this up, but it was Carlyle a Calvinist by any chance?
Well, I mean, a kind of they call it Calvinism without the theology, right? So
okay.
he wasn't a Calvinist, but he basically was. Yeah,
just the grim bits, the bits of work for the bloody
just
sake.
The dour Scottish part of it.
Yeah. My God. All right, I side with Evola.
Yeah, but Evola's like, look, you know, there's nothing like enriching about doing donkey work, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm an aristocrat of the soul, you know.
Ask the donkeys.
I'm just saying it's a very different attitude to like. He's all about like, okay, if it's mastery, okay, if you're, I don't know, like a world-class, a potter or something, and you're making masterpieces, yeah, there's something good about that. But just like working in a factory making widgets, you're nothing but the mass man. This is just making you into a interchangeable unit. Whereas Carlyle's attitude is whatever the work is, in and of itself, it's good. You know, work will set you free.
I'm on Team Evola.
I will say I have to defend the Italians a bit because I like Italians. I think there's a lot of hardworking Italians. I think this is a sort of, you know, I think there's something symptomatic here of the fact that, you know, one of the first shots in this film is the truck driving past the ruined building. This is a town that is largely bypassed by everything. I mean, you know, there was sort of incentives, if you like, you know, corruption for businesses to be elsewhere in the country. And as we'll see, you know, in this story, that's essentially the case. I mean, if you look at the Wikipedia entry for Monte Melone, I'll just read you the Wikipedia entry for it. Monte Melone is a town and commune in the province of Potenza Basilicata, southern Italy. And that's it. There's very little information out there about this town. It's just completely disregarded.
Guess at least it has a page. Now, I think Italy's a magnificent place, and I don't like all this talk of them being lazy. There's probably specific reasons why they were unproductive or whatever he's saying.
I've known people who've lived in Italy, though, Horace, and they do say things like, I don't know, if there's a leaky pipe or something, it might take you 6 weeks to get it fixed.
Okay.
You know, like, oh, they'll be there in time. When are they going to come then? Oh, they'll be here eventually, type thing, you know.
Was it like that 200 years ago, 400 years ago? I don't know. I mean, that might be because of their dirigist system. It might be because they became so state reliant that they became feeble, you know. That
could just be laid back. Just laid back, man.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know what it was like before, you know, the state really took control of such things, you know. Because in some places, you literally can't, you're not allowed to fix a pipe until the union guy comes along, you know. I don't know if it's like that. There,
I think that is a part of it because it naturally the works guy will be from the, you know, the council or whatever, you know. So, and it'd be a bit like waiting for the council to fix something here, in which case you probably would wait 6 weeks, wouldn't you? So, yeah.
Notoriously, to get a new phone in England, it used to cost. It used to take 6 months. A phone line.
Yeah. In these provinces, I will say that. The rough figures for places like Calabria and Campania, all these kind of lower southern provinces, generally it's about less than 50% of the people aged between 20 and 64 have a job. And those are figures from 2018, 2019.
That's like third world sort of living. Like everyone lives off of the income of, like 10 people live off the income of one guy or something.
Yeah. Yeah. These are very desperately poor regions.
And obviously, this is.
Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say this. I mean, you know, like obviously Sicily famously has the mafia, and Calabria famously has its own organized crime as well.
Who do they vote for these days? Is it Five Star or the League, or who are they voting for? Do they vote for Maloney? These areas,
Muslim Brotherhood.
Any ideas, Simon?
I don't know. I didn't look into voting patterns.
Yeah, I'd be interested. Okay.
Dino and his wife, Angela, were both born in Monte Melone, but they met up north in Turin when they were university students. The Communist Party asked Dino to return home and stand for election as mayor. He was full of enthusiasm, but Angela had her doubts.
No, qua non ce n'erano. E lui guarda.
Sei balli?
Dino's done well there, I reckon. Get in there, Dino.
A Torino avevamo un nostro ambiente, potevamo...
Maybe I was premature with my comment. Still, I reckon he's done well for himself.
Così, sfruttare le nostre possibilità, la nostra preparazione, anche mia e sua. E qui a Montemilone è molto difficile, perché l'ambiente non ce lo permette, sia per me sia per lui.
Perché?
Ma perché... C'è da dire molto, perché qui la mentalità è un po' ristretta, non c'è l'ambiente di Torino, cioè non c'è un cinema, non c'è un teatro, non ci sono i nostri amici universitari, i professori che ci venivano a trovare la sera, così ci trovavamo così a mangiare, discutevamo di qualsiasi cosa.
But there is a new threat to the town. Years ago, the government in Rome decided, without consulting either the mayor or the people of Montemiloni, to build one of the biggest dams in Europe just 3 miles down the road. Dino was horrified to learn that Montemiloni would get no water from this huge new irrigation scheme, and worse still, there would be no jobs for local people. The construction of the dam has become a big political issue and a test of Dino's credibility as mayor.
Il problema della diga dimostra come la burocrazia, come lo spregio del governo centrale nei confronti dell'autonomia possa scavalcare le autonomie locali. Ci sembra assurdo che si vada a compiere, a realizzare un'opera di tale importanza senza che le amministrazioni locali, le popolazioni interessate fossero coinvolte a livello di progettazione, senza che si dessero delle risposte precise ai problemi dell'occupazione, dell'uso industriale dell'acqua, della sicurezza del territorio. E ancora oggi non abbiamo ancora risposte precise sui livelli occupazionali che saranno interessati alla diga.
The more Dino delved into the story of how the dam came to be planned and financed and built by a civil engineering firm from the north using only northern workers, the angrier he became. Development aid for projects like the dam has been pouring into southern Italy for years, but the benefits and profits are always felt elsewhere. Dino has come to see his battle to create local jobs at the dam.
Just reminds me a bit of how China operates in Africa. I don't know if there's any particular relevance, but it's just like a familiar complaint out of like, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, that China will establish major projects there. Sometimes it's mining, often mining, right? But other stuff, yeah, resource extraction a lot of the time. And they just ship over the whole workforce is just from China, you know, in like Zambia or wherever, Tanzania or something, just ship over like 10,000 Chinese to work on the project. So I just wonder, like in Italy, it's a bit surprising because it's all under one national government, obviously. And it's like he's talking about the north as like a foreign invasion force. You know, they're just bringing over all their workers. Like,
it's possibly relevant to the way that the Communist Party became. It was a derivative of the Italian Socialist Party, which
Mussolini came out of originally, right?
And which wasn't a kind of big centralized affair. The Socialist Party seemed to exist, you know, with people kind of running chapters of it locally, but kind of making up policy on the hoof relative, you know, to big centralized parties, and essentially cutting deals with whoever would bring business to areas. So a kind of, you know, disorganized political feudalism, I suppose, in a way.
I think also, like, we are in England accustomed to relatively very low levels of corruption, whereas most of the rest of the world, including, I think, Southern Europe, corruption is much more common. Or, you know, just like not what we call corruption, but I mean just direct incentivization and
just localized self-interest. Yeah.
yeah, instead of like what's it called, like forms of like governance where everyone already knows the rules and operates according to the same rules, it's just more like informal deals than just formalized afterwards, right? I think that's common even in France, let alone Italy and Spain and Greece and so on. Also, just about massive dams, this reminds me, AA, of our earlier episode on Ghana. when I think of dams, I think of socialists usually, and I just think of countries that aren't doing that well. I mean, not in every case, but like, yeah, dams are often just like an ambitious thing on the part of politicians, like the Tennessee Valley Authority in the 30s, I think, which led to the Hoover Dam, the Boulder Dam in America. That was mainly conceived as a stimulus package, you could say, to use the modern vernacular. Not necessarily because there was a need for a dam or electrification or anything, but it's a way of just...
A make-work project.
They pulled that one off, didn't they, the Hoover Dam?
Say again?
They pulled that. That was one they actually pulled off, though.
Right, and it's still there and stuff. And yeah, I mean, the Three Gorges Dam in China is another famous one. I don't know whether these things are beneficial net, you know, but I just associate them with domineering states that want to impose massive projects.
The subject of dams is, I mean, if you've read any Chinese history, I've got this book here on early Chinese civilization or ancient Chinese civilization, and you get all of these different emperors who just embark on massive dam building projects. Like the history of China is a history of just enormous state-backed dam building on a huge industrial scale. Like under whole now, sections of Chinese apart. History are just building dams. Yeah.
Sometimes they fall apart and just kill masses of people as well, or flood huge areas. Like that happens. I think that happened under Mao. I think there was a major dam just burst or, you know, broke or whatever. And just drove like hundreds of thousands of people off their land and killed loads and stuff. Yeah, it's just, I'm sure a dam can be a good thing. I've got no principled objection to hydroelectric power or whatever, but just see, often it's the dream.
In my mind, it's just in Sid Meier's civilization, it's just sending the little worker to irrigate. You're just doing the irrigation in the early part of Sid, you know. But anyway, let's go.
As part of a larger struggle against corruption at the heart of the Italian state.
Se legato allo Stato in tal modo.
Se legato non allo Stato come entità astratta, ma al potere statale, che poi da noi è determinato dalla Democrazia Cristiana che lo detiene da 35 anni. Da noi non esiste il bipartitismo, non esiste l'alternanza. Questo partito di maggioranza relativa con forme di coalizione governa l'Italia da oltre 35 anni. Questo significa ossificare, significa frenare
significa
ogni cosa.
Significa anche corruzione.
Significa anche corruzione, indubbiamente. Fatti eclatanti che sono successi in Italia, per i quali la giustizia non è ancora riuscita, perché non vuole. Quando hanno poi fatto l'appalto, e anche l'appalto è tutto da scrivere come storia, per come è avvenuto appunto queste forme di corruzione.
E adesso la diga esiste, cioè stanno costruendo. Che cosa puoi fare adesso per Montemiloni?
A continuare a lottare.
That's nice grim summary, isn't it? A nice grim slogan, continue the struggle.
Bit of boilerplate Marxism, yeah.
When he was, and probably just the best he can do as well. Just when he mentioned there about the sort of the rigidity and the fixedness of the Christian Democrats, I think that was a function of American support as well. I think like where it suits them to to America, that's stability, isn't it? You know, the same set of people,
yeah,
rather than the uncertainty of an exchange of power between various groups. I think that was that derived partly from the CIA's involvement. Maybe not as late as this, I'm not sure, but you know, it was already set in place. But it's just people like Giulio Andreotti, who was the head of the CD, the Christian Democrats, for a long time, 20, 30 years, something. He's just often mentioned as having been corrupt, among other things, you know, corrupt, unprincipled, but also like America's man there, so necessary. I think it's just is the case where these figures are identified as like, that's a, you know, looking from Washington, that's a good guy. We want him to stay in place. The means by which a person is kept in place, i.e. their potential opponents are got rid of and stuff, those same means also just make it very easy and like lucrative to be corrupt, I think. You know, it's just like, I'm safe, I'm looked after, I might as well take payoffs. What are they going to do? You know, what's anyone going to do to me? I'm America's guy. I think, and you know, the little towns of the South feel the effects of that. I don't, so far, I'm quite sympathetic to this communist mayor compared to, you know, what he's complaining about.
There was something at this time called the Pentapartito, which was essentially a coalition of small parties that more or less was explicitly intended to keep the communists out.
Yeah, there's a sort of cordon sanitaire, right?
Yeah.
Frustrated by his inability to influence the planners, Dino goes to the dam to appeal directly to the workers for their support.
Come fate a resistere 8 ore con questo rumore assordante?
Purtroppo
non devo resistere con forza.
Però la retribuzione è buona perché siete operai super specializzati. Che non se ne trovano facilmente. Però io volevo chiedervi questo, io sono il sindaco di Montemirone. Nel caso in cui ci fossero esigenze occupazionali per aumentare l'occupazione e via dicendo, voi nonostante che abbiate, diciamo, un salario corrispondente al lavoro e al pericolo che correte tutti i giorni, dareste una mano agli altri operai per uno sciopero?
Vi
sentite
normale.
Va bene.
It's easy as that, eh?
Yeah.
What one of the things I like about this mayor, by the way, he just goes. our mayors would not do like, oh, right, I'm just going to go down there, have a chat with them. You know.
Tell him to go on strike as well.
He just went straight there. Yeah.
He literally saunters into the mine with sunglasses and white trousers on.
can you go on strike for some other lad's benefit? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I see. You don't get that quite as much now, do you?
It's a sad moment that watching those guys kind of smiling at him, knowing that they're all lying. You know, just knowing what. Yeah, you're asking us to come and go on strike. We're getting really well paid. We've had to come all the way down from the north to this dump, and yeah, of course we'll go on strike.
I mean,
isn't it a persistent feature of Italian politics that the North just hates the South, sees them as freeloaders, sees them as kind of basically just being carried? Isn't that what the League, the Salvini's League, was originally about? I think they were the Northern League initially, and there's a lot of resentment against the backward South, and there has been for a long time. Even Giantano Mosca talks about it, in the late 1930s, 20th century, because he was from that. He was from down south.
About something like 10 or 12 years or so ago, there was also a sort of unofficial referendum in Veneto region, the Venezia region, and it was to break away. And their main complaint against the rest of the country, and especially against the South, was just, we're just constantly paying for you. And Veneto just wanted to say, nope, we just want independence. But, it wasn't recognised by the state.
Well, speaking of Mosca, if any publishers are watching, or Mike from Imperium, a good book to bring out that has never had a proper translation. It has had one translation, but it was done extremely badly. So badly that I wonder if they just whacked it into Google and got the auto-translate. It's a book called What is Mafia? By Mosca. What is Mafia? And it talks about the extent to which the south of Italy has been dominated by criminal elements and what that's done to the politics. But anyway.
Andiamo bene?
Il
lavoro va bene?
Procede abbastanza
bene. Se facciamo qualche manifestazione per aumentare l'occupazione, vi abbiamo dalla nostra parte, no?
Va bene, sì.
Con tutti gli altri lavoratori.
Sì.
Ciao, arrivederci. Tanti auguri.
Grazie.
Vai.
lads, I'm going to need you to stop doing wheelies on your little motorbikes and come and build a dam. You're going to come? You're up for it? No, I just want to hang about doing wheelies all day.
Adam Curtis is the opposite at this moment. He's like, lads, I'm loving the wheelies. Keep doing it.
Something funny and sad about this footage at the same time. You know, it's kind of amusing, but what you notice if you look amongst the people pictured, some of these young lads are getting quite old.
Yes, there's a Fonz factor, isn't there, Simon?
Yes, yes.
Can we see someone actually jumping a shark in a minute?
I think that was it. That was the Monty Maloney version there that they did.
He wheelied the townsman.
Dino's credibility is again at stake. Despite the promise of a strike from the workers at the dam, left-wingers in the local Communist Party have called a meeting to complain that Dino's not been doing enough. To them, he's just another member of the party, and they're calling him to account.
Allora, mo c'è da chiarire. Uno, due, tre, quattro, cos'è che hanno fatto in un anno e mezzo, no?
Eh? È facile andare a chiedere conto ai compagni. Io ti chiedo conto a te dove sei stato.
I love it.
Yeah.
His opponents within the party want direct action on the dam. They're tired of promises of work. They want the townspeople to occupy the site.
Che è un problema grossissimo. No, è un problema grossissimo.
Da meglio, esatto. Non c'è.
Allora, il problema, ecco, appunto, è questo. E mo siamo arruati, no? Qua non è colpa burocratica, no? È una colpa politica, d'accordo? Dovuta a chi ha voluto gestire.
That literally is good. We need to occupy the
This is it. This is the split I was talking about, where you got some of the younger generation at this time were becoming more radical because they'd seen stuff, you know, happening in the 70s up north. And the problem is the PCI was kind of looking like just out of touch, kind of middle-aged and old guys. And they were sort of a sense that they were being a bit kind of grand and patronizing towards, you know, the actual workers in the working class who were sort of much more for this kind of let's take radical action.
Just waiting for this I'm just waiting for this mayor to pull the face. It's all so tiresome, because this is reminding me quite a lot of that documentary Empire of Dust. Mm. You know, where that Chinese guy goes to Africa.
Yeah. You messed up the railways they gave you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And is this just spontaneous? They're just filming a party meeting as it really is, or is it staged? I mean, I don't know. I mean, when you're talking about occupying public buildings and stuff, like, is that just filmed?
You probably say, oh, look, there's this English guy, Adam Curtis, and he's going to just set up his camera in the corner. Just, you know.
It's only going to be shown in England, so don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't know what you're talking about. Just. I mean, I imagine Italian communists gesticulating wildly and arguing. So,
in che modo comunale? Non sono invitati tutti quanti a partecipare. Non si è visto un cane a venire a stilare l'ordine del giorno.
In che modo andiamo a gestire, però?
E io non tolgo più queste accuse.
Vabbè, l'ha rifiutato. Non so i motivi perché.
E quando sono venuti i delegati a chiedere tuo marito di ritornare a Montemilone?
Ma io ero contraria, perché conoscendo la mentalità di Montemilone, cioè l'ambiente, conoscendo anche Dino, ero un po' contraria.
Pensi allora che Dino sia qualche volta un po' egoista?
Ma a volte sì, forse, perché lui che ha creato un'altra famiglia, cioè la moglie e i figli.
I'd like the interviewer to have followed up with when she said, "I know what it was like here." Say what, just explain exactly what it's like, and I'd love to hear have gone like, "Look, the problem is that the young men just hang around in the square all day, doing wheelies on motorbikes, and we can't make them do bloody anything. It's like getting blood out of a stone." I wish you just pressed her a little bit on what she meant. But anyway, carry on.
Deve anche dedicare un pochino di tempo alla moglie e ai figli.
E non ne dedica abbastanza?
Abbastanza no, pochissimo forse.
Fingo di stare calmo, ma sono già le sei. Se avessi più buon senso magari me ne andrei. Cerco di stare fermo in mezzo al via.
E ovviamente mi sento molto a disagio perché qui c'è una realtà molto statica e molto lenta nel muoversi, con moltissime difficoltà, con gravissimi problemi.
Ma queste mancanze ti deprimono personalmente anche?
E indubbiamente, perché da un lato danno un segno di impotenza al politico che non riesce a dare l'accelerazione giusta per risolvere questi problemi nei tempi richiesti, immediati. E dall'altro, da un punto di vista umano, ovviamente ti deprimono, perché hai delle aspettative, hai una tua socialità, hai una tua vita anche da vivere, che qui non è possibile perché non c'è vita.
Pause. Just to summarize that, it's this is the thing about this film. It's about end stage political failure. He's a man with a mission, but he has no power base anymore. He's got all this belief, but he doesn't have any organization. And there's all this potential wealth that comes in the form of the dam being built, and yet he's got no resources.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this, but this place seems like it's crying out for a dictator to make things happen. Like, how's like if that's what he's lacking, really, is dictatorial powers, isn't it, Simon?
Yeah, you get the scooters to run on time to work.
Work will set you free.
Dino's pet project is the Newtown Band, which he revived 3 years ago. Many of the children had never seen a musical instrument before. Dino has even given them the council chamber to rehearse in.
Pause, please. Oh my God, that actually was a piece of music. I was going to ask, are they just all just playing at once, but formlessly? But no.
Yeah.
Is it they were actually playing from sheets?
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't get the name of what the piece of music actually was because it's got that sort of wonderful dissonant quality where it doesn't sound like anything. But I think this is actually a direct bit of Adam Curtis coming in here, this contrast with the town band. You know, he's using this as a kind of metaphor for sort of discordant collectivity. So it's a little bit of that whimsy that we kind of know from later on.
I'd love it if he just lost it, you know. Do you remember that film Whiplash? It's not my tempo, damn it!
Yeah.
Not my tempo, just slapping the little factor with the flute.
Or he could go full Scarface, you know, he could stumble out of there. I'm the bad guy. You think I'm the bad guy?
Come on, he needs a moment like Al Pacino in that film Any Given Sunday, You know, the big pep talk, the big speech. Okay, come on, Dino, you can bring it. Like, you know, we used to be Romans once. This was the, you know, Channel Caesar was up there. This is really grim, Simon.
I can see him stamping on a trombone or something like that. Everybody, the room falls silent.
He's turning into the Doomer meme. You know that? Eyes are going slowly black.
It's almost Michael Corleone at the end of Godfather 2, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Hollowness of his eyes.
Losing the will to live.
Dino, dove vai?
Sono in partenza per Roma.
Per che motivo?
Abbiamo l'avvertenza diga, dobbiamo risolvere alcuni problemi relativi all'occupazione giù alla diga.
Pensi che ci sarà uno sciopero?
Sì. Se non arriveremo a un accordo, senz'altro.
Grazie.
Prego.
Hold on a second. Just speaking of the Godfather, that reminds me of the bit in Godfather Part 1, you know, your latest movie is about to have union problems unless Johnny's given this big role, you know.
What do you think about making his son say, you know, remember for the party, for the party? Yeah. How old is that kid, like 5 or something?
I think he is, actually. I think I tracked down a little bit about the family, and I think he was actually about 5 at that stage, yeah. Yeah, 4 or 5. And he was making him say something about citizens and workers. And I thought, oh, that's ironic.
See, she doesn't exactly contribute to the GDP of this town either. They're sitting around reading magazines and smoking all day.
When Dino leaves town, Monte Maloney comes to a halt. And life continues the way it's always been.
Curtis is in his absolute element here, Simon. I can just tell, like, he is loving this, isn't he?
Dead streets, all the noise going on. It's like a madhouse that he's kind of illustrating.
Hey.
lo stesso ragazzo come era quando l'hai sposato?
No, no, no. Prima era molto più sincero, molto più schietto. Forse perché adesso la politica lo ha fatto diventare così un pochino più chiuso.
Pause. It's just something about his, the nature of the character's optimism here. That picture behind him, I believe, is a guy called Umberto Terracini. He was one of the founders of the Communist Party, and he just died the year before this documentary. Just little notes on him. He was actually Jewish, and he stood out from other Communist Party leaders around around Europe as being the only person who openly sided with Israel in the 1967 Israeli-Arab War. So maybe it expresses something about a kind of internationalist optimism that the character has.
Am I right in thinking the Soviets supported the Arabs in that war?
I thought they did as well.
Yeah. I would suspect. I think, so.
Yeah, they supported Israel early on, didn't they? I mean, the Soviet bloc did, supported Israel in the 40s, I think. But yeah, by 67, they were firmly on the side of like Egypt, I think, and maybe Syria, Egypt at least, yeah.
I have a book by Pasha Glubb here talking about the early parts of the formation of Israel and the Palestine conflict and so on. And he's like, yeah, the Russians are behind this. The whole, like, this is a Russian scheme, the whole thing, which is an interesting perspective, because I guess that, you know, fast forward 10, 20 years and people would be like, no, the US is behind this, you know? So it's kind of in. There is a weird switching of sides when it comes to Israel.
Lui dedica moltissimo tempo a Montemilone, al comune di Montemilone, non, ecco, alla cittadinanza, ecco. Perché poi non è che finisce sul comune, continua anche qui a casa, quindi c'è un via vai.
She's gearing up for an affair, this girl, isn't she?
Absolutely, she looks unhappy.
I mean, this is like grim. There's a lot of nothing ever happening going on in this as well.
Yeah,
and he's just gone away on a trip up north as well. That's a perfect opportunity. She's about to have the affair right now, as we're watching
with Weedy Fonz, with the Fonz Wheelie.
Yeah, one of these guys who's got a bit of bravado about him. He's got no jobs, got no money, but there's a little macho quality.
E dunque, pensi che questa minaccia il vostro matrimonio?
Lo stava minacciando, sinceramente. Ci siamo sposati perché ci volevamo bene, eccetera. Allora ha salvato un pochino, forse anche perché sono nati i bambini e ci ha riunito definitivamente. Altrimenti non lo so.
Lo ami?
Beh, sì. Sì.
Lei era una volta un grande amico di Dino Labriola. Le pare che ha cambiato da quando è diventato sindaco?
Domanda un po' cattiva, eh? Beh, sì, sono stato amico per diversi anni e dispiace che oggi non c'è più questa collaborazione diretta con il sindaco Labriola. Forse, secondo me, è stato un po' il potere che ha cambiato Labriola. Io direi, anzi, una cosa, che a Montemilone, e questo dispiace, la politica ci divide un pochettino, forse perché si fa...
What's the politics? He is just trying to get people to work. What's the division, like, between Dino, who wants things to happen, and everyone else who's like, fuck off, mate, we're happy doing absolutely nothing here. Like, what's the...
Well, this is the major split in Italian politics. It's the Catholic Church. And the Catholics just went and excommunicated all of the communists quite early on. And even back in the 40s, they were, you know, through the Christian Democrats, they were counter-signaling, let's say, the communists and the socialists. They would put sort of mottos on posters like, you know, in the secrecy of the voting booth, Stalin can't see how you vote, but God can.
Right. So what's the church message? Just like pray, do weedies all day, but whatever you do, do not try to build the dam.
Don't vote.
Read Everlast.
Reed Evola. I mean, can you imagine? He goes, what are you doing all day? You've got, well, we're revolting against the modern world. Yeah.
Riding the tiger, can't you see?
We're all riding the tiger here.
I just, if people might want to see one of the early episodes of the TV series, The Cold War, which is all on YouTube. One of the first few episodes, it talks about that, about like, yeah, during the election campaign in 1948, a lot of the leading communist activists were excommunicated publicly during the campaign. And that's like, that's really shattering for them, because they were somehow Catholic and communist. And one of the women just said, yeah, well, I always dreamed about getting married in church and now I couldn't. And yeah, that is actually a factor in politics in Italy, Spain and France and stuff. Like with Franco, obviously, that, you know, the Catholic Church was a part of the reason why.
I don't want to cast aspersions about the BBC's integrity and Curtis and so on, but
you can.
Did Adam Curtis just go and find Peter Sellers and be like, Peter, mate, can you dress up as an Italian priest? It's just Peter Sellers, isn't it?
I will not do as you ask.
Yeah. He's going to do the Colonel Bloodnock voice in a minute. Yeah.
It's literally him. Okay.
Simon, can you do your Peter Sellers just quickly?
I can't do that one, though.
Confusione tra il comunismo e il cattolicesimo.
Si può essere tutte e due nello stesso tempo, secondo lei?
Ma direi di no, assolutamente di no. Ma la Chiesa, quello che condanna non è il comunismo per il comunismo, ma condanna il comunismo ateo, il comunismo marxista, cioè quel comunismo impregnato di questo veleno che è the Marxism.
Pause.
Make that guy the Pope.
Sorry. The propaganda was pretty vulgar back, you know, in the 40s and 50s. They were literally telling people that in the USSR they eat babies.
There may be some truth to that. That did happen in the famines under Mao. So I think there may have been some, or what would you call that? Auto-infantophagia or something.
In the Soviet Union.
Well, it did happen in Mao's China during the famines, like out of pure desperation. It may have happened. I mean, there was millions of people died of famine, so tens of millions affected by famine in the Soviet Union, yeah.
La saponara! Lui si è avvicinato e dice, no, non gridare così, perché... Ma che fai lì? Che fai lì?
Dino has returned empty-handed from his discussions with the Labour Ministry in Rome.
Funny that.
His only chance now is to organise a strike at the dam. But to do this, he must get the backing of all the parties on the town council.
Sorry, I missed the first... What did they say happened in Rome? I missed it cut out there. Sorry.
He came back empty-handed.
Oh, okay, right.
So now, if he's got any chance of saving the project, he has to get the strike. He has to get the strike going at the dam.
Okay.
Questa è la prima proposta: scrivere agli uffici provinciali del lavoro perché convocano immediatamente. Altrimenti scenderemo in lotta, andremo a occupare il cantiere. La battaglia alla diga non è solo per andare a lavorare laggiù, quelle 10 persone. È tutto quello che noi possiamo mettere dentro, perché è un'occasione storica. Se non lo vinciamo adesso, non lo vinciamo più. Se tu permetti, non è un problema che tu devi risolvere. Innanzitutto ti ho premesso che il Partito Socialista non era a conoscenza di questo problema.
Voglio dire, lui ha posto bene il problema, no?
Quando determinati problemi devono essere affrontati, devono essere affrontati con conoscenza alla mano dei dati di fatto preesistenti e quelli da svolgere in seguito. Altrimenti il Consiglio Comunale diventerebbe un Consiglio Comunale, mo diciamo, dell'amministrazione, non so, dove uno diceva sì e l'altro diceva sì. E siccome noi siamo tanto democratici nell'essere sempre d'accordo.
And reminder, that's a socialist. That's one of Craxi's guys, the prime minister. So, you know, the guys who are heading towards the neoliberal dispensation. And therefore, why would they want strikes?
The meeting breaks up in disarray. There's no agreement over strike action at the dam.
No way. It was funny, wasn't it, when he was talking about our demands? You know, you've got no power base.
It's just so, so grim.
Yeah.
So depressing.
In attempting to railroad the council, Dino has aroused a suspicion amongst many of the councillors that he's trying to run the town alone. There's a festival in Montemoloni. This year it celebrates the town's 1,000th anniversary. But Dino can't hide his feelings after last night's defeat at the town hall.
Nonostante sia stata pubblicizzata, non c'è una grande partecipazione, ma non è senz'altro con l'assenteismo, non è senz'altro con la fuga nel privato, non è senz'altro dalla fuga dai problemi che si possono migliorare le cose in Italia, migliorare le cose nel nostro paese, nella nostra comunità.
Montemiloni non ci offre moltissimo, anzi quasi niente, e siccome sono dei ragazzi, hanno bisogno di una strada, no?
I struggle not to sympathize with him. He's trying to make a situation where there's jobs in the town, and he can't get anywhere. And his miserable wife is like, there's nothing here. He's like, I'm trying, dear.
Yeah. And spoiler, from what little research I did around, what little research I could find, I should say, about the family, she did go back to Turin.
Oh, what a surprise.
E allora il mio pensiero è quello di portarli fuori da Montemiloni.
A te piacerebbe tornare proprio a Torino?
Ma sì.
Sappiate che i migliori vigilanti siete voi, non i vigilantes. È la partecipazione che permette alla democrazia di esistere. Grazie.
Do you think the locals are being like, listen, if this commie gets his own way, we're going to have to, like, our dream of living this never-ending party is going to end, and we're going to have to go to work. We don't want to go to bloody work. Bugger off. Stop disturbing us. We just want to grill in peace, mate.
I'd only be allowed to do wheelies at the weekend, wouldn't I?
What a killjoy he is. This place was so buzzing before he came.
We joke, that is actually a thing with communists, isn't it? They often come across, apart from all the sort of obvious things, they also just come across like, oh, we're all about jobs and work. It's like, well, I don't necessarily want a job. Do you know what I mean?
It is kind of funny how he turns up to the town festival and tells them off for not enough people coming.
Yeah, and then just goes, we must talk about all these problems. Like, yeah, you're not a classic politician.
He's a little ray of sunshine.
Mentre mi trovo a parlare di fronte allo specchio, è una grossa battaglia insieme a quella dell'occupazione, anche questa della qualità della vita che bisogna far concepire, bisogna insegnare con molta umiltà, con molta pazienza ai miei concittadini. Il livello di repressione in questo comune è enorme, anche nei rapporti umani, sociali e sessuali, addirittura. La gara a chi si presenta più, più maschio, in quanto è una manifestazione di sessualità repressa.
So now that a few lads are sort of dancing together at the festival, he's saying, well, these people are just all a bunch of homos, aren't they, really?
is that what you meant by sexual repression? I was thinking that's a bit critical.
That's the serious juxtaposition of the images. Yeah, there's the two lads dancing together. I mean
that's Curtis having fun as well, right?
I think yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, I sort of remember from things like Desmond Morris, you know, Man Watching, where he talked about Mediterranean cultures where, you know, men would, you know, they'd be a bit more touchy-feely, you know, in certain sort of customs. But, I mean, I don't necessarily think it makes them gay. But it's kind of a sort of sulky sort of verdict that he's coming to there. They're all kind of uptight, you know, they're not liberated like the Marxist bros down at the cafe.
I kind of liked him until that point, and then he started going a bit, I don't know what the word is for that, but a bit Freudian or something, you know. So I'm gonna pathologize projecting. You know, yeah,
you don't want to work in my damn construction project, therefore you're a bender.
yeah he's, it's the homosexual youth speech he's giving them, yeah.
Sono essenzialmente triste e pessimista, nonostante i miei modi che possono sembrare di un uomo.
No, I was thinking about your pessimist, by the fact you look like death all the way through this film.
Yeah.
Un amministratore ottimista. Sono enormemente pessimista. Adesso ho finito il periodo estivo. Il paese diviene un paese che più volte abbiamo visto nei film western americani. Ecco, dall'autunno per tutto l'inverno la gente sparisce, le case sono semideserte, non c'è vita.
Oh.
I have a question about what you said at the very end. There are various occasions where towns do kind of die, and there is no, there's not only, you know, no industry, but there's no reason to place any industry there. What do you do about that? Is it actually worth trying to revive every place that just because it exists as a settlement already? You know,
from what I could find, it still survives, Monty Maloney. The main thing, they do have a festival every year, and I think they've sort of changed the focus to doing sort of cultural events and like having foodie kind of festival stuff, because there's quite a lot of nice food grown in the region. So
for anyone who
doesn't look quite as bad these days, but it's, the town itself is still, you know, looks like a demilitarized zone.
In the information age as well, some people can just work from anywhere, can't they? So. I mean, food and food tourism, I can well imagine, like, almost anywhere in Italy could do that. I don't know if you guys I've been to Italy for a few days, and the standard of food just in, like, nondescript little towns in the hills is outstanding, unbelievably good.
Yeah.
So, food tourism is an opportunity.
Are you suggesting a service-based economy for this little town?
I have no idea what's right for this little town. That's sort of what I'm questioning. It's like, do you need to revive every settlement, or can you just tell people basically we're abandoning it? I mean, I know that would sound like heresy.
Blessing, he tried his hardest, and nobody gave a shit, basically.
There's a certain patriotism about it, isn't there? There's a certain, like, good-heartedness about it. I don't know, the guy's pretty kind of bleak, but I liked him until the end, you know, because he does seem like he's trying to help, like, you know, disadvantaged people, but...
Is
it completely futile? Yeah. Is it naive?
Yeah. So just to sort of round that off, I couldn't find out much more about the characters in the film. The wife, I think Curtis names her as Angela, but I think her real name was actually Maddalena. And she died in 2020. She'd moved back to Turin. And all I could find was a short obituary online and where somebody said, now you are with your grandparents, Uncle Dino and Gianluca, et cetera, et cetera. So I can't find anything about Dino Labriola anywhere. He's been utterly forgotten.
Yeah, no, I couldn't find him either, Simon. I did have a look earlier. It's nothing.
Was this part of a little series called Italians, by the way?
Yeah. 10 parts. Yeah, right. Various different characters. I think some of them are probably a bit more upbeat than this one.
Curtis only came in for the black pill.
Yeah.
He does love it, doesn't he? He loves the black pill.
Yeah,
I think I can tell he enjoyed that one. I can tell especially the really kind of slow.
Mm.
I mean, you could almost feel the pain in some of those shots, couldn't you? It's just like. Anyway, there are a couple of super chats from Port Film Co-op.
Mm-hmm.
Says Simon Accent Challenge 156, Irish Mun in a Blender.
I'm going to have to work on that. I'm sorry.
He also says, tricky. What are everyone's thoughts on the Homeland Party having its most popular activist leave the group over Homeland's alleged move to the centre? Any thoughts on such parties apart from the futility of populism? This is the story about Steve Laws leaving Homeland. I will just say, whenever anyone asks me about them or any other group, I will always give my default answer, which is I don't join anything for exactly the reasons that you're seeing right now. When you join something, you surrender yourself to basically nonsense that's coming down the pike that's outside of your control, and then you have to be associated with that nonsense. And
that's my experience.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't want to say I told you so because I never really said anything, but my default, you know, whether it's them or Reform or any other group, the same things always happen, always, especially when any amount of momentum starts gathering, then it's another one of these situations. So nothing about what has happened surprises me, really. What I will say about them is that the general idea of going for council seats, I think, is a good one. But I still think, really, it should be decentralized and not all in one party. I mean, my view is that rather than having it all centralized as one identifiable thing, each people in each locale should get organized, right? And, take over the councils that way. So it's not identifiable one group. And also, each locality will have its own issues, won't it? Each place will have its own set of issues. So that's what I have said in the past. I don't think I'm saying anything new there. So it's my general view of things.
My impression is that, it's no matter how good the intentions of the people involved, like all such parties, I mean, they are targeted for destruction anyway. Obviously, it was a surprise that Homeland was allowed to be registered and was on course, or maybe still is on course, to stand candidates, because Patriot Alternative was prevented by the Electoral Commission from doing that and still is. I think there's a lot to like about Homeland and they're trying to do things right. But Steve Law is a great guy, so I'm inclined to sort of be on his side with things, and I think I'm on his side on the issue that he disputed. But I think you're right, AA, that there seems to be so many enormous difficulties, more than difficulties, hazards with trying these things. But if people could organise in a leaderless way, sounds crazy, but organizing some sort of spontaneous, like very horizontal way across different regions but with similar methods working to the same purpose, that could be a great thing. I hope people won't be downhearted by this particular vehicle coming apart.
One of the issues is, and I mean it's a microcosm of what happened in Reform, right? Which is that if you have a leader of a group, okay, whoever that leader happens to be, let's say Farage, but somebody else in that group starts gaining their own traction or their own popularity, it is automatically then a threat to the leader, right? So how do you build something that is able to take in multiple personalities, right, where it isn't always a challenge to the leader. And I don't know what the answer to that question is, because the nature of power, as I've talked about before, always tends towards, well, what can power not stand? A rival castle, right? So if you're the leader and you allow that to go unchecked, then you don't have control over the party, right? So it's a very difficult situation to be in for any leader. And from like Nigel Farage's point of view, as an example, you can understand why he doesn't want Rupert Lowe being a runaway, like eclipsing him, for example. Or in this case, let's say central party command, right, sets a directive, but you've got, oh, this guy and this guy on social media who have massive followings trying to take it in a different direction. Well, what do you do? You can't run a party that way. So it's a quandary. I don't know what the answer to it is, because the horizontal structure that you just mentioned, Horace, or the committee structure, that never works either, right? As I've talked before, remember Vince McMahon was up against all the different committees of the wrestling associations. It's the centralized command, and it's the one king structure that ends up winning the day. But of course, within that, how do you have a situation where you get countervailing voices, where the leader does not just surround himself with yes men? And I honestly don't know what the answer to that question is. It's probably like an age old political question of organization. But one of the reasons I don't get involved, Simon, eh?
I understand. Yeah. I mean, I think Horace is maybe going to come back on that. I mean, this film we've just watched, as I said, the Communist Party actually was relatively schism free in Italy. But at the same time, there were the countervailing forces that were working to prevent it from gaining the kind of traction and visibility that it wanted to do. And, you know, I wouldn't pass any kind of judgment on the homeland situation. I'm always pleased to see people trying to organize. And at the same time, there's always the danger, like we were talking about with Nigel Farage recently, that parties either, you know, end up as personality cults, and they don't therefore have continuity and a sense of buy-in from the people following. As you say, they just become yes men, or that there is a kind of a unified program, which I think Homeland has attempted to develop. I mean, I saw Pete North give a very good talk on a workshop on community politics, so to speak. And I think he's very good, and I would say he's put in a lot of effort into this idea of creating a very detailed policy platform as a means of creating that sort of, you know, infra-party unity and sense of mission. And it's, you know, it seems regrettable that, you know, people fall out and these things fracture, and whether or not it survives that and is able to take a kind of a program forward as an electoral proposition is one thing. But at the same time, you can't help but get the feeling that, you know, there will be these the forces that seek to mitigate any attempt to organize, as I think we said in your stream yesterday.
It's even a problem at the very highest level. I mean, even Tone, even the Grandmaster, couldn't eliminate this problem. By the end, the rift between him and Gordon Brown was too much, and they couldn't live together. They couldn't, you know, they did do the crossover, but, you know, there was so much bitterness between the two of them, and counter messaging and so on and so forth. It's a difficult problem. One person who has solved this, in a way, is Trump, right? Who is so big, such a grand personality, that he can almost have like a little circus show underneath him, where there are even like factional clowns within his own administration fighting each other, but he somehow is above it, and they're no challenge to his power. But how you get that situation, it's hard to know how Trump has brought that about. And even then, you get the impression that if somebody really did start to seriously challenge Trump's himself, they'd be out the door. Like, I mean, I'm not saying this has happened with Elon Musk, but for a while it was like, oh, Elon Musk is pretty putting himself forward now, and notice how he's been phased out and phased down. And, you know, he's been demoted down the pro wrestling card, and he's barely a mid-carder or a lower mid-carder now. And he's on his way out the door. And that's because, of course, even someone like Trump cannot take the ultimate limelight away from dear leader. You know, this is just politics. So
yeah, Yeah, I mean, he seems to have the power to create a level of frenzy and kind of irrational buy-in, which kind of perhaps, as you say, at scale, can have that sort of effect. He can't replicate that without another Trump coming along. And if the project doesn't offer, I mean, it's going back to Bernays, you know, Trump is not selling, Trump is Stan, but he is selling the dream of it. And, you know, people can conceive of that in many different ways. What is, you know, as you talked about, the positive vision, the thing that people can actually all get behind and drive towards and agree on to some extent, that is going to overcome their desire to form schisms within politics. It's, as you say, it's almost too difficult. He has a compelling quality, but what he leads to is kind of not the point in a way. It's the sense of optimism that he can bring. But as we've seen, he's signally failing to deliver on the sense of optimism that he's generated. And so, you know, that project is kind of running into the gravel as well.
Yeah, I mean, even the divisions in MAGA are starting to show it a little bit, aren't they? You know, there are two distinct factions at the moment between the neo-neocons and, you know, the other. Trump is just about holding them together, but it's waiting to explode at the moment. The mega powers explode! Any more on that, Horace, or should we carry on?
No, I generally agree. I would really love to know how much the rank and file MAGA supporter really is accept Israel being put first. I would like to know, but there's probably no surveys on that. But I agree with what you guys said about leaders. I don't know how you resolve that. The flaws of the leader always become a problem, but trial operating without one, I don't see how you get anywhere. I don't know what the solution is.
Nilborg was, review Harry Enfield's love box in your living room. I might at some point, if I ever get a chance to do anything, I will make a Harry Enfield AA culture thing at some point. I want to talk about Harry Enfield as an outsider artist at some point. Futamari says, my girlfriend and I have been thoroughly enjoying These Deepest Laws. I have showed her the Barings Bank episode and she's been hooked ever since. Well, I'm glad, Futamari and girlfriend, that we can be of service. Outer Abyss says, I am the girlfriend. All right, okay, here we are. It was our first date. I tell you what, Futamari, that is a bold gambit to show.
That's almost as bold as a Salo, as a date movie.
I mean, that is bold.
Did you have a kiss? And was there a kiss on the first date? Like, talking about Nick Leeson having a little smooch, you know. I'm really pleased that this has gone on so well, because obviously there was, you know, in the first place, well, there still is, right? It's got to get more than 7,800 views, but yeah. Also, I never heard of this episode. I didn't know the last one, the one before. I didn't, all these ones that Curtis just produced, I didn't even know they existed, so this is all new stuff to me as well, and I do see the Curtis in them, so, you know, it's worth it.
This has been one of my favorite little runs, this kind of obscure Curtis run that we're doing before.
Yeah,
what are we delaying getting to?
Well, we'll be getting to Bitter Lake, will be the next Lake, major kind of modern Curtis, you know, which would be quite a dreamlike kind of voyage.
Stevie Rayner said, if Stalin led the British Empire instead of Churchill, he would have saved the empire. What would be the outrage if someone said this? It seems profitable.
Taking that very simply, I think that's correct. I mean, Stalin was not for one for throwing away power, whereas Churchill just put everything into one particular aim, which was to bring down Hitler, right? Even if that meant, you know, just destroying everything, like, whereas Stalin would have been more calculating.
Peyota says, are you going through the wiki filmography section of Adam Curtis? Will we have to suffer through the MK Ultra musical or that drama series? Well, I mean, in my mind, we weren't going to do the drama series, and I didn't really want to do the MK Ultra thing. But
yeah, we can round off with when we do our summing up stream or something. I mean, I watched the drama series. It does become, the first episode is quite interesting in the way he creates a bit of atmosphere, but then it becomes just tedious agitprop, and it just doesn't work.
We'll do Bitter Lake, we'll do Living in an Unreal World and Hypernormalization, and we'll do Can't Get You Out of My Head. and Trauma Zone.
Yeah.
But we're not going to do the MK Ultra or the Way, which I haven't seen. But
yeah,
there's all the Charlie Brooker material as well, isn't there?
We've done them.
We did the Charlie Brooker.
Yeah,
all in one. It was all in one episode. Yeah, can't remember when we did that.
Okay. Yep.
So I mean, there's probably good. If I had to guess conservatively, at least 10 episodes left, maybe 20.
Mm.
Then what we do after that, we'll have to think about.
We could just people love it. I love that people enjoy these.
I've had suggestions we do the full run of Jonathan Mead's documentaries, but God.
Yeah, we call what Brian Sewell on art, you know.
If at any point you do run out of documentaries to do Deepest Lore on, I can just find you loads more. There's loads of good ones online, I mean, you know, on YouTube and stuff. There's just one that immediately jumps to mind is it Messengers from Moscow? It's a remarkably right-wing BBC documentary. Anyway, that's just one. There's loads. So if you want to carry this on after, I'm going to just give you
what was that one that Peter Hitchens did on his bicycle? We could watch that. You know, that, remember that? I can't remember what documentary that was, but I seem to remember.
Was it Moan But Vote for the Tories?
We could watch like obscure. I don't know, but we'll cross that bridge when it comes. And that's it in terms of super chat. So hopefully the Futamadu, the Deepest Lore romance continues. You know,
it's great.
Well, imagine they watch this though, and the you know, watching the Dino and his wife opened up the rift. You know, I liked you before you got into politics, but now it's become all consuming. You know, when can I go back to London, etc.
When you say Dino, you mean Dino in the documentary? You don't
Dino
mean
in the movie. Dino yeah. and his wife, yeah, Dino and his wife, yeah.
Middle English man of the
2020s. All right, guys. Well, pick up a course at the academic agency. Where can people find you, Simon?
At Simon_Roberts on Twitter. Thanks very much for tuning in, and we should be back next week with the Great British Housing Disaster with our special guest.
Looking forward to that one. I have to make my video for tomorrow. I still haven't made it. And I on Thursday they do an international story, but I'm completely burnt out on Ukraine. I'm burnt out on Middle East stuff. I'm burnt. I feel like maybe I just won't make one. But if anyone has any ideas, leave a suggestion in the comments, because in the next hour I have to make a Thursday video. But I mean, it doesn't happen that often. But I just have no ideas this week. I feel like.
Klaus Schwab stepping down from the WEF. That'll get you lots of
boomer views. He do you know he's got a probe? There's a probe into him now.
I can imagine.
A probe.
Yeah. They're looking. They've launched an investigation into Klaus Schwab.
Launched.
Okay.
Yeah, the WEF have right. There's a probe. Right. He's facing an investigation over all sorts of things. As a result of a whistleblower. So what they're going to find, I don't know. Maybe
I don't know why, but I've got that image in my head from Godfather 3, that shot of the Pope taking an assisted dive down a stairwell, and it's Klaus's face that's speeding towards the marble floor.
Maybe Tony played him a visit. You know, you've messed up for the last time, Klaus. You know, that you'll own nothing. You'll be happy. Shit, you think you're going to get away with that? Nobody does that to the firm. Anyway, go on, Loris.
Oh no, just in the last few seconds of the stream. If anybody's got any good puns to do with Klaus Schwab being probed, I just still want to see them in the chat. Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
There is a last-minute super chat from Coney Current Year, which says, unrelated, but have you ever come across the name Alain Denilou? He was a French historian, Indologist, who converted to Hinduism. He had some correspondence with René Guénon, wrote a book in 1985 called While the Gods Play, Shaver Oracles and Predictions on the Cycles of History and the Destiny of Mankind. I have not come across this figure myself, Coney, but it sounds vaguely interesting. Any of you chaps heard of him?
No.
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 That's so stupid.
Alain Denelau. So, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And we will see you, well, tomorrow morning. I'll have some international video. Could be about Klaus Schwab's probe. We'll see. Mm-hmm. And or it could be about something else. And live, I'll see you next Tuesday for office hours. Bye, all.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.